This is episode 24 of the Software Freedom Law Show for March 30th, 2010. Hello and welcome to the Software Freedom Law Show. I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And we're here.
Well, we don't have our guest that we had hoped to line up, unfortunately.
Yep.
But we have a date now.
Yes, and we have two guests lined up for the future.
True, but the one that we talked about that was the follow-up to it's episode 2.
It's a serious, serious teaser.
Yeah, it's going to go on for 6 weeks by the time it's all done.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, because since 2-2.
Because each episode is 2 weeks.
Correct. So you've gotten used to the schedule now? It's after 2 years. Are you gonna tell people to listen next week at
Bradley,
the end of
the year? I might. And I'm definitely going to say, see you next time, or we're back at some point in this show.
We're back's fine, but see you. You don't see anybody. You see me, and I see you, and we see Aaron sometimes, but that's it. We saw Laura Moy once, because she was in studio.
That's true.
We don't normally have in-studio guests, so we don't see anybody.
Sometimes we see people we see messages from people who have listened to our podcast and reply to us.
That's true, but that's more reading, not seeing.
Well, I see their message.
If people don't use X-Face anymore.
What is X-Face?
So it was this thing. So, you know, X-Dash is a way to put something in a mail header that's non-standard, right? So anything that goes in an SMTP. SMTP is the four-letter acronym I'm trying to say. Simple Mail Transfer Protocol is what it stands for. I know these things. It's an RFC. It used to be RFC 822. I do not know. I think it's 15-something is the new one. I knew 822 because that was the old school one. Anyway. So the headers are all defined, but it's extensible. So you can do X dash and you can put anything you want in, an X dash header. So there was this thing that some MUAs, mail user agents, supported called X dash face, which you
almost made a female user agent comment.
No, M-A-I-L.
No, okay, I know.
So it allowed you to put a little bitmap string of your face. So, and mailers would display this so you would see the person's face when you were reading their email. It would display because it would be in the X-Face. You seem like, you're looking at me like this is really bad for audio casting, by the way. But you're making this face that you think is the dumbest idea ever.
No, I'm just a little confused.
Don't you want to see somebody's face when you're reading their email? This whole thing was about you want to see people, right? So if they use X-Face.
Well, I didn't say I wanted to see people. So, I just say I will see them.
So what will we give to the first listener who emails in with a valid X-Face?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
To augcast.softwarefreedom.org. We have to think of some special
gift.
We'll
give what little SFLC swag we have.
Yeah, so you get some stickers and a magnet and something else.
Oh, and a micro SD card reader.
Yes, so the first person to email in with an X-Face header that will display in GNUs. So it has to work by default in GNUs. That's the rule. It will be tested by my GNUs configuration. There's the rules.
I'm excited.
And Karen doesn't have any. Karen uses like Thunderbird or something, so she probably can't display X-Face. But I'll call her over to my office and show her the exciting X-Face you send us.
I think it's our first contest.
Yeah. And do we have to make it? Does it have to be their face, or can it be like a cool picture of some other kind?
It can be anything.
Okay, they can put anything they want. It's just nothing.
Identity.
Nothing that we wouldn't want to show anybody else. So, nothing.
Use good judgment, people.
Yeah, use good judgment. But it could be like.
Always use good judgment.
Like a picture of a GNU or something cool like that. And sorry, by the way, that was festival again, folks. Sorry. I didn't mute my sound again.
So, I want to get to the first topic that we wanted to talk about, but you just reminded me of another topic that I think we should talk about later.
How festival pronounces things
for
weirdly?
A teaser. So I guess remind me later, there was something else I wanted to talk about that came up in the first part, but I want to start out this show by congratulating you.
For what?
For being appointed to the board of the FSF.
But they voted, not me. So they had to vote me on. So it's not something I did.
No, but it's something that, actually
something happened to me.
It's, well, you accepted.
It's true.
So I guess it didn't just happen to you. You have to accept a directorship in order.
Is that actually true? I guess it's true in the sense that they could elect me, I could resign immediately. But Is it really true that you must accept before you can be voted?
Most bylaws require for directors to accept their positions. And so, you know, you'll see in minutes that I've written, actually, that at the end of the meeting where that new director was appointed, they agree that they accept. So we used to do minutes for various organizations with paper signatures. Mm-hmm. And there are some reasons why I liked that better. But you would have seen in those that we got the new director to sign on the first meeting, even though they didn't make any decisions usually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I did. I was asked.
So congratulations. Well, thank you. Accepted.
I did accept. So, I was asked and I accepted. Yes, it's true.
This issue did not come up.
I was mainly probing the issue for the curiosity of our listeners. I guess it would be sort of pointless to vote somebody on the board of directors who wasn't going to accept it anyway.
Yeah, that's true. Usually when directors are appointed, it's because there's been some discussion, no matter how much in advance or not in advance. So it's usually not a mystery.
Mine was not particularly in advance, but it was a little bit of a surprise, but it was in advance of the meeting, just by a number of hours rather than days.
Well, as a member of the FSF and as one of the FSF's lawyers, and as your friend, I find this all very exciting.
To be clear, you're an associate member of the FSF.
I'm an associate member of the FSF.
See, I'm now actually a voting member of the FSF.
You're a member of the board of directors.
And I'm probably.
I think the FSF is a non-membership organization.
I know this in detail.
I know you do.
Actually, it is a membership organization.
Oh, it is.
There is a voting. Actually, all Massachusetts nonprofit corporations have to be membership.
Oh, is that true? I didn't know that.
It is indeed. And the FSF does have a voting membership. It is. I'm not sure the full composition, but it's basically a superset of the board of directors by, I think, maybe one person.
Hmm.
And those voting members elect the directors.
That is really interesting. And it's very different. It's actually most states, or at least New York and Delaware, and I think California as well. It's not required for the organization to be a membership organization.
Yeah, I don't know why Massachusetts works that way. I think it's just because they want nonprofits to be representative of their people. So that's why the associate membership program is an associate membership, because they're not voting members of the.
And in Massachusetts, in fact, if there's at least, and I think some other states as well, if it looks like a class of people is have rights and privileges of being members, they even though maybe they weren't to begin with, they could conceivably become that.
Right, and under law. Years ago, when we set up the associate membership program at FSF, we were very clear about this. The website says very clearly that you don't get a vote when you become an associate member. That's mainly so that Microsoft doesn't buy all the membership, right? So if memberships were technically for sale, they would just buy all the memberships and take over the FSF, right? So that's why it can't be. That's why it can't be a membership organization. But speaking of membership organizations.
But it is a membership organization.
That's why it can't be a membership open to the general public, is what I mean. It's the memberships, you can't just get a voting membership by buying it. It's not a cash for member program in that sense. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
So speaking of cash for member programs, one great membership organization that is a free software membership organization is April in Paris. And you join for an annual membership and you actually become a member that votes for the board of directors and so forth. So there are free software organizations structured that way.
Mm-hmm. There are actually quite a number
that
are that way.
Oh, free software ones too?
Yeah. Actually, there are all different models. So you actually have the simple volunteer member gets a vote. Mm-hmm. So without even buying contributing and becoming a member in that way. Then there's like the contributors become voting members.
What is the distinction between so let's start for this from membership organizations. Obviously, non-membership organizations have board of directors as well. But what's the difference between the membership and the directors, typically speaking? Like, what are the requirements and rights and privileges of those two classes typically?
Boy, I didn't know we were going to get into a serious nonprofit show here today, but I always like talking about this stuff. So it's good.
Karen, we discussed it before the show that we were going to discuss.
No, we didn't.
We didn't?
No.
Oh, I must have been confused.
I think, or I must have been confused. We talked about something.
But let's talk about this. Why not?
Great.
Yes.
I'm into it.
Okay. So my question, membership directors.
So basically the way nonprofit governance works is usually within some limits what you set it up to be. So whatever the organization decides, you know, what, you know, whether they want there to be members and how many directors on the board of directors and how those interact are all spelled out in this document called the bylaws. Mm-hmm. And in the, you know, in the bylaws, they'll say things, they'll say what relationship those, you know, those two entities have. Usually if you've got a board of directors, even if you're in a non-membership nonprofit, you'll have a board of directors, and the board of directors steers the activities of the organization. So the board of directors is basically the highest authority generally when it comes to, now we'll get to the members, how that fit in, but in a non-membership organization, the board of directors is the highest authority for the organization. They make all the decisions, including appointing, you know, leadership for the day-to-day operations of the nonprofit.
So, like, they would elect the president, like, for example.
Executive director and officers and things
well,
like that.
Well, I guess
that.
Sometimes they might elect a president, and then the president would make all those decisions, right? So they would empower a president to be able to hire whichever staff they
usually
needed.
Usually the board will appoint the executive director. Sometimes the president and the executive director are the same person. Mm-hmm. So the president tends to be more of a corporate, like an actual sort of structural nonprofit corporate position. So you've got like a president, a vice president, a treasurer, and a secretary. That's different than, you know, the officers in terms of the actual activities of the organization. So, you know, usually a president is just runs the board meetings and has authority to sign contracts, mm-hmm. but you'll appoint an executive director, and those will often be different people. Like,
and they can delegate that authority too, like various authorities, like signing contracts. And
stuff. Yeah, but usually for the highest actual operating officer, like the executive director, the board would approve of that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the board approves, depending on the size of the nonprofit and what the directors are like. A lot of times directors like to approve a lot of key staff decisions. Mm-hmm.
So what I actually know, I know this, so I'm not completely green to make clear to the listeners, but for the sake of podcast discussion, I'm going to ask, what are the kinds of responsibilities that a director of a nonprofit has?
So it's funny because, for our listeners that were not at Libre Planet, I sat in the audience of Bradley's talk when he was talking about nonprofit organization and the Conservancy in particular, and I raised my hand and I asked a lot of really simple questions, just to make sure that they were covered at particular points of the talk. So now you're doing to me what I did to you during your talk. So a director, as I said, the board of directors is sort of the highest level of authority for an organization. I didn't answer your question before, which was how do the members interact with the board of directors? So depending on how the bylaws are set up, often I think the most common arrangement is that the members appoint the board of directors. So in some ways, the members
elect,
yeah. But they make the decision as to who the board of directors are. So in a way, a lot of times the members are the highest level of authority for the organization, because while they may not make all the specific decisions about how the organization is run, because they choose who makes those decisions, they are ultimately in charge. And there are a lot of times provisions where members can oust directors if they don't like what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So the membership has to stay happy, and therefore the board of directors, in effect, reports to the membership. Mm-hmm. So that's the way a lot of organizations are set up.
So it's very democratic when you're a membership-based organization, basically. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that makes sense from a sort of nonprofits organization workload issue. It's so much easier when the organization has no membership, because it's just so much less paperwork, and you've only got one class of voting, which mm-hmm. is the board of directors. And you don't have to deal with, you know, how many members there are and having elections, and if you want to amend the bylaws or if there's a mistake or something, it's a lot of effort to have an election on that scale.
Right. The way the FSF handles it is it's kept generally the voting membership relatively small. So,
well, you said it is almost the board.
It's a high overlap to the board of directors, although mm-hmm. I don't know it currently, but the last time I checked long ago when I was used to work at FSF, there were one or two people who were voting members, but not on the directors. And that was mainly former directors who didn't have time to serve as the directors, but they were willing to at least be available to evaluate it. Because basically in the FSF case, the main job of the voting membership is to evaluate and consider new candidates for the directors. Mm-hmm. So
you asked me what directors do generally.
Yeah, that was
or what their responsibilities are. And that, you know, I think that's usually to stay involved with the organization, stay aware, and find out, you know, for example, read all the financial reports, make sure that you have all the information to know what the organization is doing. And then also make very top-level decisions about the direction of the organization. And that usually means that, like, board members directly do things like set compensation for top-level employees. If the directors get paid, usually the directors make that decision, but it sort of depends on whether all directors are getting paid, and usually have independent directors that are outside the organization. And
all the places where I've been a director, it was basically Software Freedom Conservancy and FSF, the volunteer directorships. Mm-hmm. So there's no, I get no salary for the work that I do for FSF or Conservancy in those cases. So I'm
just
used to the volunteer, which is it's not wrong in any way for directors to be paid for their job. And it has to be disclosed, right, on the 990.
Exactly. And, you know, you'll see if you take a look at SFLC's 990, for example, that Evan Moglen, who's on our board of directors, is also our executive director, and he's paid in his capacity as the executive director, but that means he's a director that is paid. Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting thing. People a lot of times don't know this, that the executive director is a title that's evolved in nonprofit space over the years, but for somebody to be the executive director, they may not be on the board of directors.
They often aren't. For example, the FSF.
Yes,
right. Peter Brown is the executive director of the FSF, but he's not on the board of directors.
Right.
And you were executive director of the FSF and not on the board of directors, and now you will be on the board of directors, or you are on the board of directors, but you are no longer the executive director.
Correct. That last one was a little obvious, but the rest of it was useful.
I don't know. I think it's really interesting.
I think that title director is actually, my feeling is the reason it evolved, this is purely my personal theory, is that oftentimes the person doing day-to-day operations was not the president. As you were pointing out, the president usually has this more corporate-y kind of role and wasn't necessarily the day-to-day executive getting things done. And that's why I think the title executive director evolved in the nonprofit.
See, company. I think we have really confusing terms anyway. So we have titles where we have director of this and director of that. And, you know, for example, we have a director of communications here, but she's not, or I don't actually remember what Lysandra's title is, but she's not a director on the board of directors, nor is she executive director. It's just that we use the term director to mean all sorts of things if you direct a certain area of the practice.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing about nonprofit space. That was the other thing that I think evolved in nonprofit space, this use of the word director in this way. I think it's a softer word than the kinds of words that get used in for-profit corporations. And I think the word director kind of lends itself.
I don't know, because I think that for-profit corporations have all sorts of confusing titles too, like vice president of this and vice president of that. And you'll actually get that in the nonprofit space too. Like if you look at Apache has tons of vice presidents because each head of each individual project in Apache is called the vice president of that project.
Yeah. Well, the vice president is this strange thing, particularly in the for-profit corporate space, that evolved as this title you gave to people as basically just a meaningless feather in a lot of cases. So people are called vice president in the corporate space just because they've been at the company for a certain amount of time.
But a lot of times it does have meaning because it means a certain pay grade or it means a certain level of success.
True.
And so it's, you know, each organization is different. And I think that sort of the term director of X or...
But it's so different from what...
Not the director of X.org.
Right. But I say foo these days, never X because of that.
Except you didn't on your talk at LibrePlant. Not to
I
go back to this.
It. I fixed,
but you
I
did say X,
myself.
And then you did what I did, myself. Made a joke about X.org.
Okay. So, but my point was that as soon as the word vice president stopped meaning the person who takes over if the president is assassinated, right, which is what most people think of as a vice president.
And usually that's what it means
theoretically
in the nonprofit space, because usually the corporate, like sort of the vice president of the organization is simply there to take over if the president can't do their job.
Right. So, and I think that's what most people, particularly in the U.S., because of the way the U.S. government is structured, think of vice president as meaning that.
And it holds up within the, I mean, so in other words, so I think it's actually not that confusing for people to think of that. So for example, at the Software Freedom Law Center, Dan Ravisher is the vice president, and the only sort of the responsibility of the vice president in that role is to take over if the president is not available to do the job. So it's sort of, it's an analogy to that U.S. government thing.
True. Unless you're Dick Cheney, in which case you're actually running the country.
So anyway, so directors have a duty of care and a duty of loyalty towards their organizations. So they have a duty to basically stay aware of what the organization is doing and and to help steer what the organization does. So they have to participate at meetings. You can, if you're a director, you can miss a meeting or two, but you do have an obligation to read the material that's distributed to you. If you're not getting information about the organization, you need to ask why. You should stay abreast of all of the directors, all of the organization's filings, make sure that the organization is making the filings, make sure you understand what, and I'm saying you, and I'm sort of speaking generally in case any of our listeners are asked to be board members. This happens around us all the time, in part because we're creating organizations and people need directors.
Yeah.
So it's really easy to look at the person in front of you who's shoving the paperwork in front of you or advising you whether to make your organization or not, to ask them to be on the board of directors, but it happens a lot. So I'm saying you, I'm also saying you because you were just appointed to be a director at FSF, but you know all of these things anyway.
Yeah, that's right. And I've also served on the board of the Conservancy for I guess, end of 2006, I joined the board of Conservancy, somewhere around there.
So. But as director of the FSF, you were also very familiar with the role of the board of directors.
Yeah,
of the FSF.
I mean, we had a very good interaction structure, which continues to this day. And I actually sent an email to the staff of FSF to let them know that they could reach out to me. I think that it's actually somewhat easier, I think, to be on the board of directors of a small organization. I know everybody who works for the FSF. Mm-hmm. I hired many of them when I was there.
What's really cool
is that I met the ones who have come to work there since I left. So it's very easy for me to really know what's going on because I can ask people personally on IRC and say what's been going on in the last few months and those sorts of questions, which in a larger organization, it's not feasible to really have that connection to the staff.
Now, as a director, you also don't want to you don't want to micromanage, but director is a pretty high level position. So,
yeah.
But I was going to say is it's really cool that you've had almost every level of involvement at the FSF.
It
because
is true.
You were a volunteer, you were an assistant, and then you were, you slowly.
Yeah, actually, I wrote it on IRC the other day because Matt Lee was joking that I should apply for the internship position again. And I actually pointed out to him that there was no internship program when I came up through FSF. I actually established the first internship program, so I never actually got to be an intern. So I said, I've never been an intern because I went from volunteer to RMS assist to vice president to executive director to volunteer to board of directors member.
I really wonder if I wonder if there's ever been an instance where a director was an intern.
That would be kind of weird.
Probably not.
But I didn't want to apply for the intern.
If you guys know of any situation, let me know.
But yeah, I believe FSF is looking for interns, and I won't be your competition because I don't want to apply because I would probably get it, and then I would be holding up an internship position that somebody else would
also
want.
Also, you would probably do as a volunteer whatever it was that
probably true.
would ask
as
you to do as
a volunteer
an
director,
intern.
I would do it. It's true. So I have had a lot of different positions at FSF over the years. Of all different styles. But yeah, certainly my plan was not to micromanage it. Mainly what I think is important to do as a director is really make yourself available to the staff. And that's what I'm trying to do in reaching out to them is make sure that they feel they have somebody to call. I know when I was executive director of FSF, I relied heavily on the board of directors, sometimes on a daily basis.
I actually think that's a little bit above and beyond. And I think it's unusual for the board of directors to be accessible to employees of an organization.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you're right. The executive director needs to have a dialogue with the board of directors because the board of directors is their boss.
Mm-hmm.
Basically.
Yeah.
In a public charity, to some extent, the public is their boss. But, in practice, the board of directors is the one who the executive director has to report to.
Yeah, but this is you're correct, I think. It's more part of my personal philosophy because I believe in high levels of transparency for all forms of leadership. So I really feel that it's important that as a director, I be accessible to everyone, the public as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a danger in that, right? Because you can end up getting too much email, and I don't know how much email I'm going to get now that I'm a director of FSF about FSF. Maybe I'll change my view if I get inundated with people asking me FSF questions. But generally speaking, I feel that making yourself available as a director of something and saying the public can be in touch with me and ask questions. And
I agree. I just think that directors often don't have all the details because they're working on a much higher level.
Agreed. And I think actually the key part is listening. I think that's the real issue is knowing, I feel as a director, knowing what the public feels about an organization I'm the director of and hearing from people about how they feel about our campaigns and our plans. Collecting that information in a really direct way, I think, is very useful. It's true that you might not have all the information, but going into a board of directors meeting, having heard from people, being able to say,
to ask questions and get the full picture.
Right, I've heard from the public. Some people are concerned about this. Some people are asking questions about this. What can we do to help express that?
And then there's actually a whole other sort of set of circumstances where you want to be accessible for the staff, and each organization has a different policy for this, but a lot of organizations have one, and the IRS actually now asks on their 990 if organizations have whistleblower policies. And in those policies, basically, in most whistleblower policies, directors are identified, preferably independent directors are identified, so that the staff has someone they can go to who's not their boss directly and complain about something they think is going very wrong in the organization. So that's another example of where you do want to be accessible to the staff. If they see something going very wrong, which you wouldn't expect over at the FSF, but, you know, with every organization, you have to be prepared for something to go wrong. So that's a situation where you do have direct, because I realized that I said there is no communication usually between employees and directors, but that's an example where you want to make sure that that path is clear.
Yeah, it's. I think FSF is in a much better situation with that regard, because they have their unionized workforce. Mm-hmm. So they actually have a union.
They're very
process.
Unusual in that regard.
I know they're unusual. But I think it's a very good thing. I think unions are good things, and I'm glad to be in a directorship where there's a union that we're working with, and we have communication between management and the union. I think that's good for a workforce to be unionized, generally speaking. Even though I'm in FSF's case, I'm technically on the management side, which I was when I was executive director as well. I still think it's a good thing for workers to be able to organize. I think it's good. So, and I think it helps with things like a whistleblower type situation in those situations.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason why the IRS now asks the question of, do you have a whistleblower policy? It's because putting these procedures in place, whether there's a union or not, is essential to make sure that you don't have any kind of abuses of power within
Agreed.
An organization.
Yeah, so, I think it's harder when there's no union. There's sort of no recourse other than the whistleblower policy, I think.
And yeah, I mean, basically, you need a solid board of directors, you need good governance, you need bylaws, and you need policies to deal with these situations so that if things go terribly wrong, people find out about it within the organization so that the situation can be remedied quickly.
Yeah, it's a good amount of responsibility, I think, to be on a board of directors, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a real love. As I said, it's a duty of care and a duty of loyalty. Mm-hmm. You have to, I totally lost my train of thought in the middle there. But
well, and the other thing is people tend to. I'll just move on. And then
okay, no, I was gonna carry on and say that directors do need to be loyal to the organization and forward the organization's interests. And in our space, that's something that sometimes gets difficult because you have directors who are employees of companies for a lot of free software projects. This is not really as much of a problem with the FSF or the Software Freedom Law Center, but especially where you have free software projects where the companies that use the software are directly involved in the in the board of directors and have the seat because they're so involved and they give money to the project. That's when you sometimes have a problem because, you know, even though everyone knows that, you know, that such and such director is an employee of a company that has an interest in the software and maybe has an interest in what license it gets distributed under. There could be a conflict of interest for that director because he's got a duty of loyalty to the organization to promote the free software project on its own terms and as part of the public, or maybe not even the public charity, as a part of the nonprofit. But at the same time, they've got loyalties as an employee of their organization that may have an interest in the software. So that's sort of a particular conflict that we have in the free software world that I think is not as common in other nonprofits.
It's probably true only because there are companies interested in the work of nonprofits, which is less true, I think, in other places.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I never worry about such things because I would never choose my employer over an organization I loved. So I would just go with my duty of loyalty to the organization.
Well, sort of the FSF, which while it does produce software, is more of an advocacy organization. It's a little bit different than, you know, an organization that's set up to, you know, around a particular free software project.
It's true. But one of the interesting things that I want to ask about duties of loyalty is when you're on multiple boards of directors, which I am now for mm-hmm. the first time in my life. I've never been on two boards of directors at once. I was actually on the board of directors of until just now. The user group that I was involved with in Cincinnati, I was on the board of directors for a year.
You just told me about it recently.
Again. I know, and I forgot. In this conversation, I forgot that that was actually the first time I was on the board of directors of something.
Right.
And I had forgotten that. But I was never before I've been on two boards of directors once, which as of this week, I now am. I of course, very carefully disclosed my things I have to do for Conservancy and how Conservancy works, and made sure the FSF's board knew that, so that they would know what they were getting into some sense. But how does that all work?
Usually when people are on multiple boards of directors, it's not a problem because you've got different nonprofits, you know, and it's rare that nonprofits would have conflicts with each other. In the situation where they might. So for example, I can think of a situation where there's a grant and both organizations are applying for it, or,
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, I mean.
So how does that, how do we handle that? Give me some good advice, which I know is not legal advice.
I mean, you know, I could see that being hairy, and it's very difficult for lawyers for me to think about a situation that hasn't arisen. Yeah. And I can think of all sorts of weird facts that, you know, so you have to take situations as they arise. But usually if there's a conflict, you have to disclose that conflict to both boards of directors. Mm-hmm. And then often that means that you would probably not be a part of the decision making if you could avoid it.
One and not the other, or both? What's better?
It depends on the conflict, right? If you're conflicted, usually it means you don't want to be a part of the decision-making process for either organization, because if there's a conflict between the two organizations, there's a conflict at both organizations. So, you know, I mean, you have to take the situation as it arises. It may not be practical for you to recuse yourself from a decision. It may not actually be a conflict. Each organization usually has their own conflict of interest policy, and you need to read that policy to make sure that you were following it properly.
Yeah, I mean, my general rule of thumb has been, if you're disclosing everything to all the parties involved, it's relatively hard to go wrong, because everybody knows what's happening, and and the people around you can advise, well, we would prefer you to be not involved with this because of what you've disclosed to us, and so forth. Yeah,
disclosing is probably the major step, but it's not enough all of the time, because sometimes that could even backfire, right? Because you could disclose that you have an interest, and your other fellow directors, in trying to make your life easier or better, may forget that they need to follow their duty of care and duty of loyalty to the organization, and may try to make your life easier once you've told them that you have an interest. So, you know, usually policies say you have to disclose, and then you have to evaluate as to whether, you know, whether it's appropriate for you to be involved in the decision, whether a decision can be made, you know, what the options are. And most policies talk about that.
But would it be fair to say that knowing is half the battle?
I don't know how to respond to that.
Well, it's probably
What?
It's probably half, right? It's not like you had two halves of what you were saying there. So disclosing was half, and the other half was evaluating. So knowing is half the battle.
Knowledge is power.
I don't know what that one's from. So should we wrap up this segment of directorship discussion? Was there anything else you wanted to tell us?
You know, I wasn't really expecting it to be such a big discussion about nonprofits, but I think it's really useful for people to know, because I think people, I keep encouraging people to take a look at Form 990s and understand how the organizations you care about or you donate to are run. But another thing to look at is, who are the directors, and, you know, what organizations are they affiliated with? And, you know, look at it from that perspective as well.
Yeah. So now everybody knows I am a director of the Free Software Foundation. I am a director and president of Software Freedom Conservancy, and I am an employee of SFLC. And those are all my affiliations. Oh, and I'm vaguely affiliated with a thing called Outflop, which is to write poker software. But I'm really not that.
And I try to avoid all directorships.
Yeah. So I've got a lot of policy. But none of my affiliations are in conflict, as far as I can tell.
I have affiliations, but you're affiliation with
question copyright, right?
I'm a lawyer to question copyright. Mm. So that's not any different than any other organization that I am a lawyer to.
True, but it's something you do as a volunteer, not as part of your SFLC.
Yes, but I'm lawyers to other organizations and individuals in my free time.
Oh, I didn't know. Do you want to list all your clients for us?
No. But basically, I have a hard time when friends and
but the question copyright thing's
people
public,
are doing
right?
Interesting. Yeah, question copyright is public, and you know, whenever I think people are doing something that's really exciting, I want to help. So you know.
So there you have it. You can email Karen.
No, and... I've got so much.
I was kidding.
I was sending out lawyers, you know, lawyerly work product at 2 o'clock in the morning last night.
That wasn't last night. That was this morning.
That was this morning.
The clock turns over at midnight.
I thought I really have to cut back on all of these volunteer projects a little bit. just to get things in hand. But yeah, and I'm also an officer of the Conservancy, which has fiduciary obligations as well.
Oh, that's true.
And I'm an officer of the Software Freedom Law Center.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Yep.
You got more stuff going on than I do.
So I do, but I don't have any directorships because being an officer is sort of a lower level obligation than being a director. Phew.
Yeah, you got a bigger list than I do.
So we'll see you in a moment when we come right back.
We won't see anybody.
And we're not coming back.
So, Karen, you went to two conferences in the last, 2 weeks or something.
Yeah, last week I went to, was it last week? It was, right? Because this past
weekend. I guess it was. We're on Friday. We're recording on this on the Friday before the Tuesday one release. So
That's
it
right.
was last week for you, 2 weeks ago for everybody else.
So, yes, last Thursday, a week ago yesterday for me, I went to OSBC, the Open Source Business Conference. And then right after that on Saturday, I was at LibrePlanet.
I was at LibrePlanet.
We were both at LibrePlanet.
I was at LibrePlanet.
I was also at LibrePlanet.
I was at LibrePlanet.
No, I was at LibrePlanet.
So you were at
we're
OSBC
on fire
first.
Today.
We were at OSBC. You were at
and
OSBC.
You were not at OSBC.
I mean, they don't want me there.
I was actually, I wasn't expecting to go to OSBC, but I was actually filling in for another person from SFLC who wound up not being able to give their talk at the last minute, which was really interesting. Especially going right from OSBC to LibrePlanet because they're such different conferences. I mean, it's fascinating. OSBC
corporate
is,
and anti-corporate.
Yeah,
matter and anti-matter.
FSF's not anti-corporate.
Well, it's the uncorporate, I guess. That was certainly an uncorporate conference.
It was pretty fun.
Yeah.
Not that I don't think anyone will be angry with me if I say that OSBC wasn't fun. I mean, I had some really good conversations with a few people there, and I got to see a few of our clients who happened to be there, and I was really excited that they were there. But most of the people that were there were representatives from various businesses that use free software. And
well, they would say open source,
they would
I'm sure.
Definitely say open source. And I sat there in the legal track for both days. I didn't go to every talk, but I went to a lot of them, and it was really amazing because there were all these discussions about us, about SFLC, and basically they were basically lawyers talking about how best to prepare companies for when SFLC comes a knocking. In fact, there were small slides in different presentations that says what to do when SFLC knocks on your door.
Well, that's silly from a couple of different fronts. First of all, they're referring specifically to GPL enforcement, which is a big part of my life, but it's only a small part of all of SFLC's life.
Yep.
So it's a little over-focus on that, first of all.
Also, you know, so I actually got to say, well, actually, I'm knocking on your door right now because I want to talk about these issues when they're not problems. I want to help you understand what your obligations are so that, you know, we're not in a compliance enforcement situation.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that the companies can't change their way of operating such that there wouldn't be a threat of that. Because so much information available on our website. There are other FSF has stuff on their website. Or I guess it's our now because we're anyway. But FSF's website and SFLC's website both have lots of information about how to avoid. I've just been, because I do the enforcement for the BusyBox project as a big part of my work. And the BusyBox guys just made more prominent on their website information about what to do.
And,
so everybody wants to explain to you what to do.
And we, SFLC, are an educational organization. Like, we want to publish information so that, you know, we want to educate companies. We'd rather educate companies and have them comply than be in a situation where we have to bring lawsuits. So, and there was definitely not.
Or let alone lawsuits. I don't even want to have to write the letter that says you're in violation. I much rather never get to the case that there's
absolutely.
Even violation. I mean,
absolutely.
Lawsuits are like a whole nother level of you completely ignored us when we told you you had a problem, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So there's a distorted view of SFLC in part because a lot of our work is giving, and we've talked about this in other episodes, but a lot of our work is giving legal advice to clients that isn't public. And so what people definitely see, though, is when we file lawsuits. So even though we do a lot of compliance work that we don't file lawsuits for, that stuff isn't public. The only thing that's public is what we file, you know, what we wound up having to file lawsuits over. So I think people and lawyers and companies or company lawyers in particular have a distorted view about what enforcement is like at SFLC and what its goals are.
So were you able to clear that up with some of these business folks?
I think so, actually. I had this, you know, I wasn't actually speaking, I wasn't actually giving a compliance talk. I was giving a license conflicts talk, but I nonetheless snuck in a compliance slide as the first slide of my talk, and I got to clear up some of the things that made me nervous that other lawyers had said in their presentations. And I also was able to sort of bring the point home of, you know, when developers release their software under a free software license, it's because they want you to use it. It's not because they're waiting, you know, in the wings to sue you. And I think that actually is lost on these people.
I think it is too. And the strange thing is that the level to which they will go through hoops to try and negotiate complicated proprietary licenses with partners and other places. Or as the case with Microsoft, shaking people down for patent licenses. I mean, these companies go into a great deal of negotiation to get a patent license from Microsoft, and everybody just sort of accepts that as the normal business practice. But to read a simple free software license that gives you tons of rights and all it asks for is to make sure everybody gets the source code or an offer therefore, it seems out of whack for people to be saying, oh, this is such a danger and so forth. The real fault is, of course, to their suppliers who aren't informing them. And I would love them to demand their suppliers to be telling them, look, we've included free software and you have to comply.
But there's a really positive flip side to this that we've been talking about for some time here at SFLC, but which I hadn't really seen firsthand, which is that, you know, while there's sort of a negative knee-jerk reaction to an organization that brings lawsuits and people are scared about the SFLC bringing lawsuits on behalf of their clients, what's really cool is that because of the lawsuits, lawyers are taking these issues very, very seriously. And what's cool is that they now have the tools, because they have the specter of the SFLC coming after the company, to wave in front of the company executives and say, the risk here is not trivial. We have to comply. You know, if we're using this software, we have obligations under the license and we have to satisfy them. Mm-hmm. And actually that was the best part of all of OSBC, was sitting in one of the sessions. It wasn't my talk. Somebody else was talking, and there was a discussion about, you know, the scope of completing corresponding source code. And this one in-house lawyer, stood up at one point and said, look, we know what the obligation, when we're honest, we know what the obligations are, and it's not that hard. And a lot of people were nodding, and nobody countered him. And that was really amazing and wonderful. And I think that were SFLC not to have brought those suits on behalf of our clients, I don't think that conversation could have ever taken place.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I'm doing the bad thing for audio because I'm making faces, the reason I'm basically, I guess, chagrined about that is that I feel like I wish we hadn't had to do it that way. Why couldn't they just do what most companies do, generally speaking, and comply because they join the community and get involved with upstream? It's just really unfortunate that in so many cases, the only thing that companies seem to understand is fear. And I don't want it to be fear. I don't want people to be afraid of the GPL.
No, and I agree. It would be preferable if people would, if these companies would have just complied on their own. But at the same time, how many times are there engineers and lawyers that, you know, are excited about the GPL, that are excited about copyleft in a company and are in this awkward position where they're saying, you know, we have obligations. We can't violate the license, and to not be taken seriously. Now we've given them the tools to be able to say, you know, this is a serious matter. In the past, before the lawsuits were brought, I can imagine 1,000 conversations where that engineer would say, hey, you know, we're using GPL code here. We have obligations, and to have an executive say, oh, well, what's my risk? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the engineer says, well, you know, we have, you know, this could be copyright infringement.
Yeah.
Or a lawyer, and then have the executive say, well, has it ever happened? Has anyone ever brought suit? Is this a real risk? And if the answer is, well, I can't quantify the risk because it hasn't happened yet, or whether it will ever happen is one thing. And to say, well, actually, these major companies were already sued because they were infringing is actually very compelling.
Yeah,
so whether it's the stick or the carrot, I don't really necessarily care as long as there's compliance.
Yeah, I I mean, obviously, I agree with you because I spend so much of my life doing GPL compliance, but I'm sad that that was the only thing they understood after all these years of trying to educate.
Well, I think that's why it took so long for, I mean, because well, the FSF and, or that's what I was going to say, is that there, the FSF in particular, you know, has been doing compliance for a very long time. And, you know, it wasn't until relatively recently that any lawsuits were filed on behalf of any plaintiff.
Yeah, I know. But and that's, we do what we have to make sure the GPL is upheld. And to transition to Libre Planet, actually, my first day at Libre Planet, I don't think you made you, because you had the overlap with OSPC, you couldn't make it to the Friday hacking sessions. But I actually did a really long marathon session first about the state of mobile, which basically is stuff we covered in our mobile podcast. So there's no reason to repeat that here. And then the second half of the day, I actually showed people how to do the most technical part of GPL compliance, which is checking the source code. And
that's
I did
so
a
great.
Live demo of that, which, I proceeded to break.
Did you violate the Black Duck patent? I'm just kidding.
No, I didn't get far enough to do that because I ended up spending most of the time screwing up various Fedora truths because I had to build this particular piece of software on Fedora. And I used Debian, obviously, and I have truths set up for Fedora. And then there were no repositories because they wanted me to use a very old version of Fedora. Sometimes you get build instructions, which can be completely valid build instructions on the GPL that say you need to use Fedora Core 4 because that's what we used and we only know if it builds under that. Well, that's a valid build instruction. Problem is getting your hands on a working truroot for Fedora Core 4 is not trivial, especially now that there was a project that was maintaining old archives of Fedora. Debian has one too, but the Fedora one's kind of gone away and it's really hard to find current packages. So everybody watched me break all my Fedora truroots and not be able to find editors in various Fedora truroots and not have an editor and then have to go back out of the truroot to edit a file. And so I thought it was a horrible presentation actually because it was, and then somebody came up to me after and said that he really liked it because he said it was more fun because we got to see you make all the mistakes. So I felt pretty embarrassed that in the end of it, I didn't actually show building of anything because the build kept failing for various reasons related to my truroot not being right. But people seem to enjoy watching me do a CNCS check and how annoying it is.
Well, that's why, I mean, LibrePonet was so fun, is that it was the free software community, the FSF's free software community. And so that was just, it was like a breath of fresh air after OSPC to hang out with
the
ideological crew was so much fun.
And there was a track, I was actually mostly on the technical track for Sunday, but there was a women in computing and women in free software track as well, which I unfortunately didn't get to much of because I was in the technical track.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that's what I wanted to mention when we started this episode and I said, use good judgment, people, about what's appropriate to send us as a part of our new contest. But you know, I think that's sort of the message that came out from the Women in Free Software track, which is, you know, there are, people have very different views about what's appropriate to accommodate women and encourage them in free software. And I think the message that everyone was able to, or the point that everyone was able to agree to, is that if everyone used good judgment and tried to avoid saying things that would make anyone uncomfortable about any topic, like, you know, whether it's, you know, a woman or being uncomfortable, being made uncomfortable because of some sexist comments or racist comments or any kind of inappropriate comment, you know, the answer is really, you know, use good judgment. And if you see someone who is saying something inappropriate or that could make people uncomfortable, call them out on it. Because a lot of the times the problem is not the fact that there is one nasty troll, you know, one person who's saying nasty things in a channel, it's often the silence when others don't correct them. And whether it's because the folks remaining silent are thinking, well, it's obvious that this person's a troll and I don't even want to engage him or her, it doesn't matter because the effect is that it discourages women from participating, it discourages minorities from participating. That's not acceptable.
It reminds me of something a mutual friend of ours said, which I'll tell you off podcast who it was, because I don't know if they want to be publicly quoted. They probably do, but I would want to check with them first. But this person said, you know, people complain so much about political correctness being annoying, but if you look back at the way things were before political correctness was a concept, there were people got away with saying a lot of things that were never checked and never questioned. And there is some value in having a certain level of decorum, basically, that we all adhere to. It's you sometimes feel constrained, but on the other hand, the other outcome is much worse.
Yeah.
That if you don't take the effort to think about who might be bothered by various comments.
Yeah.
And so forth. So it's there's some value, I think, in political correctness, and it did change the level of discourse and the kinds of things. Like if you watch the example we were talking about when this quote came up is if you watch like old TV shows from the 80s or movies from the 80s. I mean, the classic example is it's not a women's issue, but a racism issue. If you look at something like that Molly Ringwald movie. With the Pan Asian character.
Oh right, 16 candles.
16 candles. I mean, that's so horribly. You watch that today, and it's so inappropriate. And the fact that was thought as appropriate humor in the late 1980s, you have to think, we've come a long way now. You look at that now, and you can see that wasn't really appropriate. And I think things like that, we have improved, and we have to learn how to.
I think it sometimes can get tiring to talk about these issues, but I really applaud the FSF for having that track. I think that. Even just raising these issues on a continuous basis helps. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that.
So how do you feel like the outcome? I feel bad. I missed it. There was so much technical stuff that I really wanted to go to that it was tough for me to get in there. But how do you feel it went?
I mean, I think there was a lot of good discussion. Of course, there was, some inflammatory discussions because invariably when you have a discussion like this, there's one or two individuals that think it's fun to debate people. And there are a lot of people there who had.
Did you say debate or to bait?
To bait.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. And I think for some women, it was in part for women in particular, I think that had stories they wanted to share. I think it was a really good experience to be able to say that in a room where it's not just other women who've had bad experiences hear them, so that, developers generally can hear what kinds of things can happen and have happened and do happen. And to understand that these are serious issues and to hear why someone might get offended or be made uncomfortable for a comment that may otherwise seem innocuous to someone who hasn't been thinking about it. So I think that's pretty good. I think we need to find other ways to bring this conversation into a wider audience. I thought the session was really well attended, but I would prefer for these discussions to be held in a broader group of people. Like I really liked that last year's talk at OSCON that Kiralee gave, because I thought that
she was a keynote. Yeah.
Yep. So. Because it was a keynote session. She talked about a lot of these issues in a really positive way. We've actually referenced that on this podcast before.
Yeah. It's an issue that's really important
Oddcast.
To me.
Yeah. Our cast.
Yeah. Well, I haven't been. I'm not making it a language rule or anything.
No, but I agree with you on that, and but I actually kind of like cast.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of sci-fi to me.
So I it's an issue that's really important to me. I often feel unsure what I can do to improve the situation, other than basically the normal things everybody should do, which is, is treat people with respect and question and call it out when there is something that's done that's not appropriate. And make it clear that's not acceptable.
I think that use good judgment, people, is a good standard.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough for people sometimes. I think a lot of people are coming from a lot of different backgrounds, and there's some level of education that has to happen. And I think we've got to find a way to do that in our community. It's a problem. I wrote a blog post about this on my personal blog. That this is actually a problem that's computer science wide. People have pointed out that it is worse in free software. Mm-hmm. But I saw, and I've written about this on my blog, so I won't go into detail, but even in my undergraduate science department, there were various different sexism problems, and many of the women felt not comfortable in the lab because of the locker room style environment that was created.
Well, that was my experience exactly in our computer lab when I started college, and I went in to complain, and the head of the computer center offered me a job. And I think if I hadn't been made uncomfortable, I don't even know if I would have worked in a computer center, and then I don't know if I would have cared so much. I wouldn't have had all the experiences that I had that led me to this point now. So I'm really grateful for that. But it was having been made uncomfortable that caused me to get angry and to become more involved. And that's not really the gold standard here, but it's a problem that I think most women in software have experienced at one time or another.
Yeah, and the reason I mention people coming from different experiences and backgrounds, I really confused. I'd be completely honest about my experience with it when it happened in my computer science department in the early 1990s. I wasn't a perpetrator, but I was sort of on this weird, do we want to end free speech kind of attitude.
Yeah, it's not about free speech. That exactly. Came up in this session, yeah. Which I was really glad for.
I'm educated about that now, but at the time, I can imagine somebody like myself at that time mm-hmm. not really getting it. And I had trouble delineating between when it's free speech and when it's creating an environment that's unfriendly to people and how those two things interact. It took me a while to really get a good sense of that myself. So I'm sure other people struggle with that.
Yeah, a sexist or racist comment is inappropriate for a particular forum is not saying that you shouldn't have the freedom to express that view elsewhere.
Right. And it was certainly a challenging concept for me to get used to and understand and be able to get comfortable. And it also hurt the communication, the ability to communicate and for people because people were often talking mm-hmm. past each other about the issue.
And the point that came out of the session, actually, that I thought was valuable and worth repeating, and maybe we can wrap it up after that, is that not only is it unfortunate because the woman or the person who is made uncomfortable tends to leave that community, but all of the folks that were silently made uncomfortable, who maybe didn't speak up after that event happened, also lose interest in the project. So in fact, when you have that kind of dialogue happening in a community, you really, it often that whole free software project is hurt because you lose such a large section of participation. So it's not just one person. If one person's made uncomfortable, that often means that many more people are uncomfortable. And the way that people usually feel, especially if it's not addressed directly, is to just put their efforts somewhere else.
Well, and I've seen this just for any issue that becomes an emotionally charged issue in a free software project, particularly young free software projects that don't have a lot of contributors or history. They're very fragile in a sense that that it can dissolve as a community mm-hmm. very easily. And any type of situation where, be it this issue or any other, where there's incredibly emotionally charged attitudes, and people get out of line in the way that they communicate, it can just dissolve a community.
Yep. And usually, the person, or a lot of times when the person has made the comment, they may not be thinking about the way it could make somebody else feel. And if you just say to them, you know, I don't know why you would say that because it probably would make somebody uncomfortable. And I know you probably don't feel that way because you don't, you know, allows that person an out and gives them a chance to say, oh, I was just making a joke. I really think that, you know, for example, I really think that there are many fine programmers who are women, and I would like to see more participation by women in our community, that it gives them a chance to correct what they've said when maybe they don't even realize that they've said something bad.
And I'll put my little pitch in here. I think that we rely as a community too much on email. Email is a very imprecise and problematic form of communication. And when obviously we have to use email, we can't get around that, but we have to look as a community of ways to move away from email. I've often encouraged projects to have weekly conference mm-hmm. calls. We can do this with voice over IP and make it cheap for people. Don't use Skype, please, but set up an Astro server and let people dial in. And it's pretty easy to get bandwidth from places donated for free software projects to be able to do that and allow people to hear each other's voices. Even if the only speakers are the project leaders and everybody else just listens, that hearing each other's voices can make a very different thing. And people are less likely to say something, quite frankly, over the phone or in person, people are just less likely to say something offensive. It's just a fact.
Yeah. That said, email us if you have anything to say. podcast@softwarefreedom.org.
Or IRC, /SFLC. And we've had one email, you know, Karen, asking you to join
IRC
channel. One person listened to me on that, but which I'm sure that's not going to convince you. Well, Laura Moy was on there looking for you yesterday.
Yes, I know. She found me elsewhere.
But not on IRC because you
she found me on IRC. Note.
Well, yeah.
But yeah. Donations at softwarefreedom.org/donate. I think that covers it. And thanks for joining us and listening. See you next time.
You hear us next time.
Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
You know, they're even called man pages.
But you know, the best application in Emacs to use to read them is called woman.
Really?
Yeah, that's what I use. See?